This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, global demand for exotic pets is on the rise, including those trafficked from the Pacific. We'll talk to a researcher about the impact of the illegal animal trade on the region's biodiversity. And in Fiji, experts say young voters could hold the sway of power in upcoming elections, and some of them are sick of current leadership.
I'm not saying it in an offensive way, but their way of thinking might be outdated to way of life in Fiji now.
Also ahead, it's been 3 years since Bougainville voted to become an independent nation, but there's still much uncertainty about the territory's future. We speak to the PNG diplomat at the heart of discussions, all that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan, so glad to have your company. First, though, an exodus of Pacific workers to Australia and New Zealand are hurting local businesses. And now Vanuatu and Samoa are taking steps to stem the flow. The two countries are looking to place caps on their labour mobility programs, just as both Australia and New Zealand expand the scheme as major worker shortages hit industries. Dubrovka Volodar with this report.
For the past year, Pacific workers have been flocking to Australia and New Zealand as labourers. But an increase in demand in both countries is prompting Vanuatu and Samoa to consider regulating the number of workers leaving their shores.
There's an increasing demand on the seasonal work programs, which kind of like compromise on the availability of skilled workers in the domestic markets. And it's also, of course, it drives some of the brains away from the country.
Keenan Banasi is an employment specialist with the International Labour Organization in Fiji.
The missing link is how we ensure that these programs are sustainable, and it also has an impact as well upon their returns to their own country.
The ILO is helping Pacific countries, including Vanuatu, Samoa and Fiji, to develop their new employment policies.
Samoa is about to adopt their second national employment policy. Vanuatu now committed to adopt their employment policy for the next five-year cycle. In Fiji now, we are currently working on updating and introducing the second cycle of the national employment policy. And we see more interest in other countries as well.
By the end of July, there were more than 26,000 Pacific workers in Australia. 28% were from Vanuatu and 16% from Samoa. And the numbers will grow, with a pool of 52,000 Pacific workers approved to take up jobs in Australia. Simeon Tavoa is Vanuatu's acting commissioner of labour. He says details are still being worked on, but they're looking at a more targeted approach.
For people who come from the outside the areas, outside of the town, those are the people that we want to really target. So now we're looking at how we're going to maintain a domestic market and grow a domestic market, a human resource within our domestic market, while the rest who are eligible to go, they can go overseas.
Mm-hmm. And are you looking at a possible cap of workers as well, a limit to workers?
I think at the moment, I really cannot confirm that, but that one is still in discussion at the moment.
Peter Foliaki Lokutui from Vanuatu looks after Pacific workers in Victoria. He's concerned it could restrict the ability of his countrymen to earn a living.
They want to restrict them, but they'll have to put something in place to sort of balance that out.
In Samoa, the government says it's looking to cap the number of seasonal workers. It will only allow one group to travel to Australia and New Zealand per month to prevent shortages of workers. It's unclear how big those groups will be, how workers will be chosen, or the exact timeline for it. Labour mobility expert, Emeritus Professor Helen Lee, says it will be a juggling act on the part of Pacific governments.
Because if they lose the stream of work, you know, such a big stream of workers, they are going to lose that remittance income. So it's going to be a real balancing act of keeping, you know, enough skilled people in their countries, but also allowing people to go overseas and earn more money, because clearly wages aren't going to go up to any kind of equivalence anytime soon.
She says host countries could do more to better support these workers.
With a bit of imagination, there's all kinds of ways that it could be mutually beneficial, much more than it is now, where people are just being brought here and quite often exploited and just used, as I said, for just manual labour when they have so much other potential.
On the farm fields in Mildura, Peter Foliaki Lokutui has one plea on behalf of seasonal workers.
If those on the grounds there where the government restrict them, at least equip them so that they can get, you know, a hold of that market as well and still make the money.
That was Peter Foliaki Lokutui, ending that report from Dubrovka Volodar. And the ABC has contacted the Samoan government for comment and more details. We are still waiting a response. You're listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. It's been almost 3 years since Bougainville voted to become the Pacific's newest independent country. But years on from the referendum, there's still much uncertainty about Bougainville's future. One person at the heart of discussions is PNG's Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister, Ivan Pomaleo, who joins us now. Secretary Pomaleo, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Krishi, and good morning to your listeners.
Good morning to you. And
It's Priyanka, isn't it? Sorry.
Yes, that's right, Priyanka. Krishi is our star technician who might have helped you get on the line. But Secretary, I'm so glad to have you on the show because, well, let's start with the basics here. Will Papua New Guinea support and indeed grant Bougainville its independence?
It's been made very clear by our Prime Minister that we are very committed to the process of as prescribed under the Bougainville Peace Agreement, that is something that's important to us. We've been engaged, albeit slow, but over the last 12 months, since about May of 2021, the two leaders have engaged over three consultation processes. As you know, under the peace agreement, after the referendum, we then go into a consultation process, which would then allow us to talk through the important things that we need to have, the timetables, the different milestones that are required to finally get the results of the referendum and the outcome of the consultation to Parliament for deliberations.
I mean, why has it taken so long? I understand that the referendum still hasn't been tabled in PNG's Parliament. Now, it took place 3 years ago. Why is there this hold up?
The peace agreement doesn't prescribe a timetable. We completely understand that it's important to the ABG people. There's a number of important factors. It might come as a surprise to everyone, but as soon as the referendum was held, we then had the presidential elections in Bougainville. Then COVID came in, and the first consultation was held in May 2021. And in that consultation, a number of key things were discussed, including the actual nature of actions that would be taken in Parliament. We needed to talk about the timetabling, the scheduling of different activities and milestones that are mutually agreed by both sides of the discussions to finally build a roadmap that was agreed to in Waabeg around July of last year, and then we worked through the what was known as the Eraqona Covenant, which was signed in December 2021 in Ella Beach, and then worked through the different requirements, including the need to draw up a constitution regulation that finally settles all the important milestones agreed to in Waabeg into a regulation. The key part of the regulation is that once we enshrine everything that we've agreed to in Waabeg and a few other things that is part of the Eraqone covenant, then that is locked into a constitutional regulation that allows both sides to work through.
Sorry, Secretary.
If I may just complete.
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
If to enshrine all those milestones into the regulation so that it's locked in, and any change to that will only be by mutual agreement.
Okay, understood.
And the timetable is established in WABEG is for the method to be tabled into Parliament in 2023.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of hurdles, a lot of meetings, a lot of consultations, as you've detailed there, before this referendum can be tabled and some movements can happen. Is this all leading towards Bougainville's independence, or is the Papua New Guinean government considering other options?
At the moment, I don't believe any other option is clear. At the moment, we're building a process of bringing the referendum result into Parliament. You used the word bureaucracy. I'd like to restate that as an important constitutional process that we are following.
Okay.
And there is no option other than the one that's prescribed in the BPA. The only issue that we are working with the ABG team is to clarify what actions Parliament will take when the matter is tabled.
Okay, and I understand that part of these discussions is to build a time frame, but do you know roughly when we might have a resolution on this, when Bougainville might be finally declared independent as that referendum found 3 years ago?
The time frame is what I know. The outcome of Parliament is what I don't know. I don't think anyone knows at this stage. We're making sure the boxes are ticked so that Parliament can do what it has to do.
So it's Parliament, the MPs there, that finally decide on independence on Bougainville, or are they deciding on the process to gain that independence?
No, we're getting Parliament to make a determination on what they do with the referendum results. That would be a point of discussion. My paper in Canberra a week ago pointed to the divergent views that exist on the matter relating to Section 342 of the Constitution, which we believe, at least from the national government side, that the Parliament has a voting responsibility to deal with the results and the outcome of the consultation. I believe the ABG contends that it is an endorsement process, noting the large involvement of both sides into the process of referendum and the peace agreement discussions over 20 years ago.
So that I have it clear, Secretary of Pomaleo, there was this vote, this referendum 3 years ago. Bougainville overwhelmingly voted for independence, but there's still the process for it to go through Parliament, and it's the Parliament that will ultimately decide whether they will uphold that referendum or whether they'll choose another path. Is that correct?
So one of the things that we have to do as part of the process is to build some very clear understanding into a constitutional regulation. We're getting our technical teams to get back together to talk about that. What we need to do is to clearly define the action that Parliament will take. As I said earlier, there are two views to that, and we recognize that to start with. And we recognize also that those differing views will be a subject of important strategic high-level consultation on...
Are those differing views about independence of Bougainville? Are those differing views that you're outlining there?
The views, Priyanka, what action does Parliament take? Does it vote on the result to say yes or no, or do we simply, or does Parliament simply endorse the outcome of the referendum, the results of the referendum? That's an important question. We believe the intentions of the Bougainville Peace Agreement and the enabling constitutional amendments of over 20 years ago required for Parliament to vote. And when it does take an action, once those actions are clearly defined for both sides, then it gets you an answer of whether Bougainville will be voted yes or no in terms of the referendum result, or we look at other options. But that's what I'm saying. I'm saying we are working on clearly defining that, and I imagine that the work on building the terms of the constitutional regulation will clarify that for both sides.
Yes, I understand.
The timetable for WABEC is to get that matter to Parliament in 23.
Yes, I understand it is indeed an important issue, as you stated, Secretary Pomaleo. So just to make sure that I understand it completely, so Bougainville might not have independence. It depends on how the MPs and Parliament decide to approach the situation. Is that right? It's not 100% assured that Bougainville will become independent.
I don't think that's a question for me to answer. That's for Parliament to determine. We've always made it very clear.
Indeed, is that who decides?
As long as we define the process and what actions Parliament will take, it's up to them to determine how they deal with the results of the referendum. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, understood. And just finally, Secretary Pomaleo, thank you so much for your time. When will this vote in Parliament happen? What are the processes until that 2023 consultation, I understand, in Parliament?
So the broad timetable is that we agree to the constitutional regulation. We lock all our processes in there. We conclude a report that comes out detailing the important consultations that both ABG and government has undertaken, and then we agree on when to take the report of the consultation and the results of the referendum to Parliament.
Okay, so still some...
The broad timetable is 23. The discussions on making sure the report is ready is ongoing. The divergent view of what specific actions Parliament will take once sorted out, then the matter goes before Parliament. WABEC determined that action takes place in 2023.
Okay, so still some important work before that 2023 yes. possible Parliament.
I think it's also important that all of us, both sides of the conversation, recognize the important timetables that we've agreed to, and we'll be working hard to make sure we meet those timetables.
Understood. Well, Secretary Pomaleo, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That was Papua New Guinea's Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister Ivan Pomaleo speaking there about those important steps to happen around Bougainville's independence 3 years after that referendum vote.
Hold the front page!
Yep, it's that time here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia to find out what's making news around the Pacific. And I'm joined, as always, by Carl Evans. Good morning, Carl.
Monday morning again. Good morning, Priyanka.
Yes, I know. It feels like we were just here, you know, did a weekend actually happen? But some important news has happened over the weekend, one of them being around Marshall Islands receiving UN support over its nuclear legacy. We reported a bit on that and, in fact, had the representative of Marshall Islands to the UN, or the deputy secretary, I believe, there last week. What's happened since that interview? What's actually happened?
Yeah, so some good news on that front. The UN Council has adopted a resolution aimed at assisting the Marshall Islands in its efforts to secure justice for people suffering from the impacts of nuclear testing. So obviously the Marshall Islands suffered pretty heavily from weapons tests carried out by the US in the 40s and 50s, including the biggest bomb ever detonated in 54. It's led to some environmental consequences for their people, as well as health impacts such as high cancer rates and things like that. So the text was tabled by five Pacific states, including Samoa, Vanuatu and Fiji, and it was also backed by Australia as well.
And now we were hearing reports last week that current nuclear powers, places like India, China, the United States, Russia, were criticizing this effort by, you know, Pacific countries led by Marshall Islands. Did they have anything to say about this?
Interestingly, they didn't. They had raised concerns, just saying that they didn't believe the UN Council was the right forum to raise this issue. But some of those bigger countries that you just mentioned, they didn't actually vote on the motion, and it got through.
Oh, very interesting. Well, yes, we did hear the Marshall Islands was very confident last week, so we'll see actually what impact this vote might have there on that nuclear legacy. Now let's head to Vanuatu. The election is just 3 days away. Yeah, very, very soon. And there is fears of corruption now in the election campaign. What is that?
Yeah, so this is according to the Vanuatu Daily Post. There's certain candidates, or they're hearing anyway, from what they say is reliable sources, that are offering money for votes in Port Vila and other areas. So it's come as quite a concern to the chairman of the Electoral Commission, and local police now have come out and are encouraging people to lodge a report if they see this sort of activity happening. So it comes after the commission released its list of 219 candidates who were very much in full campaign mode over the weekend. I was reading reports of music and drumming in the streets and things like that. And 61 of those candidates are former MPs, and there are 302,000 people registered to cast their vote in 3 days' time.
Yes, 302,000 people, but I saw there was some discussion on Twitter whether that's the number of voters or the actual population of Vanuatu. I understand there's some confusion there's people who can't actually vote in the electoral roll, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the electoral commissioner did confirm that that register actually dates back to the 1980s, which is actually, you know, I was born in the 80s, which is a long time ago now. So, yeah, we can safely assume that a lot of those people would be dead. However, they can't actually change the register until they've seen a death certificate. And I can't imagine there'd be a lot of people sending their relatives' death certificates into the electoral commission.
Yes, that's an interesting note. But yes, very interesting to see how that might play out just in 3 days' time, that snap election. Now to some sporting news. England have, it's a sad thing to say, obliterated Fiji 84-19 in their opening game of the Women's Rugby World Cup. A lot of hopes were pinned on Fijiana, still are. Some were saying that the match, though, was closer than the score indicates. Is that the case?
Yeah, kind of. So, I mean, look, while large, I mean, 84-19, yeah, let's be honest, that's a big score line. Yeah. But it might have flattered England a little bit. So England did jump out to a 17-0 lead. I mean, they were heavily favoured. They're sort of the gold standard in women's rugby at the moment. It was the first clash in 16 years between the two sides. However, Fiji responded in a pretty big way in that first half, very much on the back of their forward pack, who played very well, laid the platform for a few of their backs to find some space, and scored two really impressive tries in the first half to only trail 24-14 at the break. The English captain, Sarah Hunter, even said after the game that Fiji's physicality and just intent to run the ball really shocked them.
So that's what happened in the first half. What happened in the second half then?
Yeah, well, obviously, yeah, they were very shocked and they responded. responded in a very big way. England just dominated around the ruck. Pretty much just, yeah, piled on 10 straight tries to really not so much take the spirit out of Fiji. I mean, they still tried, you know, very much to the end, but, yeah, really put their stamp on the game. Fiji did get a late try by way of Lavina Kavaru, who scored just before the final siren to wrap up an overall, a pretty good overall performance, I think.
Okay, and what's next for Fiji, for the Fijianers?
So they'll play South Africa on Sunday. So, yeah, get a little bit of time to lick their wounds and yeah, I'm sure they'll build on that performance.
And England was the, I guess, hardest team to go in, so South Africa we might see a different result?
Yeah, I think, look, it'll still be a tough game. South Africa are obviously very much a powerhouse in world rugby. That being said, though, I think, I don't think they'll be as strong as England, so hopefully a bit of a closer affair.
Yes, fingers crossed. Well, thank you, Kyle, for all those stories from around the region.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was Kyle Evans bringing us the latest from around the Pacific. But don't go anywhere, because there's still some news here on the show. Young people in Fiji are gearing up for national elections. A date for the ballot hasn't been called just yet, but young voters say they want a change of leadership.
I'm not saying it in an offensive way, but they're old. Their way of thinking might be outdated to the way of life in Fiji now.
We'll head to Fiji very, very shortly, and we'll also be speaking to a researcher who's been tracking the illegal trade in exotic pets. Global demand for the wildlife is on the rise, and that includes animals from Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands. Which ones exactly? Well, we'll be finding out in about 10, 15 minutes or so. Thank you for joining me this Monday morning here on Pacific Beat. Fiji's election date is yet to be announced, but across the country, young people are preparing to make their voices heard. They were the driving force behind the 2018 vote, and this year, experts say it will be no different. Yasmin Wright-Gittens is in Suva with this story.
For many voters in Fiji, this is only their second or third election. A lack of youth representation is an issue that has weighed on many voters' minds, with mixed views on how critical it is to democracy.
Some members of parliament advocate on youth issues, but we do not see a youth present in parliament. I would just want an individual, a youth preferably, to be proactive and be active in the youth scene and just be vocal on youth issues in parliament.
Young people, well, I would encourage young politicians to stand up, but they might not have the key experience that's needed.
They've been in the political scene for too long. In Fiji, some of the political parties, they just raise some certain issues at that time, the kind that really appeals to the Itoke people. Like for the Itoke parties, most of them just bring up land issues. Sometimes they also don't bring up education and youth. And I also think that they may not think it in an offensive way, but they're old. Their way of thinking might be outdated to the way of life in Fiji now. That's why.
Penny Matnasinga is one of the youngest provisional candidates running for election. He is vocal about the lack of youth representation in parliament, saying he can represent youth in a way that current parties do not.
Here in Fiji, you have a culture of silence. Yeah? When there's the elders tell you something, you do it, you follow. So I am standing because I think that if there's a youth that thinks that they can do it, why not? It's different when a youth represents youths. They feel more comfortable of sharing their issues. It goes back to the culture of silence of the Pacific here in Fiji especially.
He is running with the Unity Fiji Party and says he's determined to change the government's pattern of attracting young voters but spending the money elsewhere.
Governments come when they do their elections. They come to the youths, engage with them, get them to vote for them. But then when it comes back to giving back to the youths are ignored. For someone to stand up for the youths and like look into youth problems and help youths, that's what we're lacking, and that's what I feel like I'm standing for in these upcoming elections.
Benny is familiar with barriers standing in his way. It's the reason why he's running for office.
Before this, I was a flight attendant. So when I was flying, I used to serve business class and I'd serve diplomats and politicians and all these other dignitaries from other countries. And just having a conversation with them was really intriguing. Eh? So I'd talk to them about all these issues, economic, climate, and they'd talk to me about it. And I got so interested in it, and to the point where in 2019 I left and I came to study politics. So that's one point too that I'm trying to advocate on, is the involvement of youths, because youths are the future of the modern society.
The youth vote is a focus for political parties, with under 35s accounting for more than 60% of the population. On their mind are the recent COVID pandemic, education, employment, crime, and health.
As a USP student, the current government that is withholding the grant that is supposed to be given to our university. So yeah, maybe that will be one of the key reasons.
The key issues that I'll be focusing on is education, youth employment, and cultural heritage, and arts and music. Because I think these are important factors and sectors of our country that is kind of lacking behind and being neglected by our leaders. So I think these are the key issues that I would focus on.
In my own opinion, there's a lot of youths that are waiting for the upcoming election because of the government. They think of this government have a lot to do with bad activities that involve the country.
Aidan Cranny is a research fellow at La Trobe University, looking at youth leadership and engagement in the Pacific. He says one feature that stands out is the role of social media in politics.
Across all platforms, we see young people engaging in ways that they're not able to in everyday civil society, in everyday politics, in the village, in their homes, etc. There is a small but growing cohort of what I refer to as critical civil society, and these are the young people who are very politically active.
He says the growing wave of political engagement may show up in the election result.
At a broader level, young people are concerned about the very nature of politics in their country. They grew up in a period of uncertainty and instability. They are referred to as coup babies because they were born during periods of non-democratic rule. And they are very concerned about the stability of their politics, the security of their democracy. The winds of change are blowing. This may not mean necessarily a change in government, but it does definitely reflect the fact that this looks likely to be a tighter election than we have seen in the past. And this could be quite a fraught and tumultuous period. As soon as the writs are issued, then we may see really interesting strategies and also stories dropping in the media.
The election date may not be known, but the push to register Fijian voters is well underway, with a polling date set to be announced in the near future.
That was Yasmin Wright-Gittins reporting there, and production support was there given by Angus Delaney. Yasmin and Angus are new Colombo scholars at the University of the South Pacific in Suva. You're listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Global demand for exotic pets is on the rise. Many of them are animals caught illegally in the wild, including those from Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea. Animals at risk are regulated through an international body, but its list only includes less than 10% of the world's animals. Freya Waters is a PhD candidate from the University of Adelaide and has been tracking the movements of unlisted species being trafficked into the United States. She joins us now. Good morning to you, Freya.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I was fascinated reading this article and a bit about your study, particularly because when we think about illegal animal trade, we think about poachers and, you know, the rhinos being hunted for their horns in Africa, but not necessarily people actually wanting pets for their homes. What can you tell us more about this trade? What are the animals in demand, and who is behind this?
So the poaching of large charismatic species is actually really only a small slice of the wildlife trade. And when we refer to the trade in live animals, there's a huge industry for both legally and illegally obtained wild animals for the exotic pet market. Most popular species include reptiles, amphibians, and even invertebrates like spiders and scorpions. And we find that most of the demand is coming from more affluent countries such as the United States, countries in the European Union, Britain, Ireland, and even places like Japan and Hong Kong.
Wow, so tarantulas, reptiles, not your typical pets, I guess. I guess that's why they're exotic. If we know about the countries that are receiving the pets, do we know where these are predominantly come from and who's actually sending them over, how this exactly works?
So they come from pretty much all over the globe. There's few centres of trade in both Southeast Asia, Africa, and Southern Asia. So how the chain works is there's usually local individual harvesters. They're usually from economically poor communities. They'll collect the species from the wild. They'll then sell them to middlemen who then usually send them on to global exporters who will supply the retailers in the end destination countries. So, for example, they'll sell them to online-based or physical pet stores in, say, in America, who then sell them to the public.
Oh, interesting. I know the article that went up online had an Instagram post selling, I think, a baby otter, which I have never come across, but very interesting. I mean, is that behind the demand increasing? Is it online sort of spurring it on? Do you know why this trade
definitely.
Is increasing? Yeah.
So the fact that trade has moved from physical stores to online is definitely a factor because everything is so much more available. Also, social media platforms like Instagram and TikTok, they depict wild animals in captive situations where they're looking cute or they might be very unusual and colourful, and this really spurs on the demand for those species.
Wow! Yeah, I definitely have seen those. I haven't seen a spider looking cute yet, but I have seen some of those odd monkeys, even an otter, I think, on Instagram. Yes, with that cute profile. I mean, looking closer to the Pacific, I understand you've also found some Pacific countries or animals from some Pacific countries being traded, particularly from Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea. Let's start at Solomon Islands. What are the animals there that are being traded?
Yeah, so just to start, data for unregulated species is actually really hard to come by at an international level, and the United States is actually one of the few countries that does keep extensive records of all the wildlife that is imported, and it's also the largest global importer of exotic pets. So we use this data to look at which countries supply the US with unregulated wildlife, and while the Solomon Islands wasn't a big player, it still exported several thousand live wild animals, which were mostly lizards and frogs. And it was really the only Pacific nation that supplied unregulated wildlife. The species with the highest demand from the Solomon Islands was the Solomon Island leaf frog, which is only found in that region. Mm. And while populations are currently considered stable, we don't really know what impact trade has, and we only have data from what one country is importing. And in the US, the demand for the leaf frog was actually increasing, and in 2010, only 50 animals were exported, and this grew steadily. And by the time the end of our data in 2018, over 1,000 animals a year were being exported. To America from the Solomon Islands.
Oh, wow. And that's a massive increase.
Yeah. And while not a lot of animals come out of Papua New Guinea, Indonesia is a large-scale wildlife trader. Mm. And many of the species collected for the pet trade originate in the New Guinea province. Mm. So we can't say whether these animals are only harvested from the Indonesian side. And pythons are targeted quite regularly due to their ability to fetch high prices. Animals like green tree frogs are caught in large numbers. They're very easy to catch. And so one survey of local traders found that 52 species were collected for the pet trade from Indonesia and New Guinea, and nearly half of them were traded illegally.
Wow. I mean, is part of the difficulty researching this as well and finding exactly the extent of the trade? Because, you know, as you said, there are a lot of middle countries, middlemen working to traffic these animals. That must make it difficult to find out where these animals are coming from exactly. Is that right?
Oh, yes, definitely. So the United States, as I said, is actually one of the only countries that reliably records wild... The United States is one of the only countries that actually records its imports of unregulated species, and that is a really, really big problem. What we really need is to be recording the trade in all species that are traded internationally so we can keep track of what, how and when is being traded.
And what impact can this trade have on local environments, Freya?
Well, without recording the trade, it's impossible to know exactly what impacts it's having on wild populations. But it can definitely leave many species to over-exploitation, which can lead to population declines and also follow-on impacts to the environment. There's also conservation risks that are associated with the trade of wild animals, such as biosecurity and zoonotic disease risks, and also invasion risks when people release those non-native species into the environment when they may be sick of having a pet or it grows too large or too complicated to look after.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. Some of us were chatting just before the show, my producer and I, and apparently I think in Florida there are giant pythons that have been let loose from former pet owners.
Yeah,
have you heard of that?
That's actually a really big problem there. And they've noticed declines of native predators in up to 90%. And some species such as the bobcat, the raccoon and rabbits really, really decline in areas where there are pythons, and they find that they're more abundant in areas where the Burmese pythons haven't reached yet, because they really just replace them as predators on the food chain, and they also consume quite a large quantity of native wildlife such as, you know, birds, amphibians, smaller reptiles, smaller mammals, and, yeah, they really outcompete and outsource native species.
Yeah, that's so we might see impacts not only in the host countries that have lost these animals, but also in the countries that are going to, these animals are being exported to, or trafficked to, I should say. What's the solution? Is there anything that we can do? That is there calls for better regulation? What is the solution to this problem?
Yeah, so there isn't a simple catch-all solution. Some people suggest bans, but this can actually increase illegal trade, and it also unfairly impacts the local communities that might rely on wild harvest for income. And it's currently very hard to understand the drivers of demand and also assess if trade is sustainable, because we don't monitor the trade in a vast majority of species. So I think what we really need to start off with is an integrated framework to monitor the international trade of all wild species. And I really think that wealthier countries where this demand originates, they should take the leading role in pushing and funding for such a global solution.
Yes, making it transparent, I guess, to make sure we know the extent of the problem first before trying to combat it. Freya, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yes, likewise. What a fascinating subject about the trafficking of exotic pets. That was Freya Waters, University of Adelaide PhD candidate, speaking to me there.
Tune in to SBS Samoan News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoan News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoan News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. And we're just about heading to the end of the show. If you do a reminder of some of our top stories, we
started off by looking at how some countries in the Pacific are looking to put a cap to stem the flow of Pacific workers to Australia and New Zealand. They say that these seasonal workers going overseas is hurting local businesses. Vanuatu and Samoa, we're hearing, have been looking into introducing caps on numbers there. And it's coming at a time when both Australia and New Zealand are also looking to expand the schemes themselves because of major worker shortages hitting their countries. So a bit of a competition for Pacific workers underway. We also headed to Papua New Guinea to get the latest on talks around Bougainville's independence. It's been almost 3 years since Bougainville voted to become the Pacific's newest independent country. But years on from the referendum, there's still a lot of uncertainty about Bougainville's future. We spoke to PNG's Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister, Ivan Pomaloleu, about what is expected. If you want to catch up in any of those stories or anything else we looked at today on Pacific Beat, just head onto our website. That's abc.net.au/Pacific. Or if you type in ABC Pacific into your search engine, you should find us. You can find our latest stories and also any of our archives right there. I'll be back tomorrow morning here on ABC Radio Australia. Until then, have a lovely day.